Okay, very good. So I've divided this colloquium into two parts. The first one is an introduction to entanglement and tensor networks. And the second will be an application of tensor networks to study the renormalization group on the lattice. So let's get started, but remember it's a colloquium. Please feel free to ask questions, especially the students. So the first part, the introduction, it's based on 3 points. The first one is that we know quantum mechanics, but when we try to use it for many body problems, we don't really know how to use it, or we don't get to use it due to a computational problem, namely that the computational cost grows exponentially with the system size. Then the second point is that in recent years, we've learned about many-body entanglement. And what we've learned is that ground states of many-body Hamiltonians obey what's known as the entanglement area law. And that makes those states very unusual from some perspective that we will discuss. And the third point then is that by exploiting this structure of ground states, namely that they obey the area law, also in recent years we've been able to come up with efficient ways of representing and manipulating these ground states in terms of these tensor networks. So you can think of a tensor network as a sparse structure that you can use exploiting the area law to overcome the exponential growth of complexity that we would otherwise encounter in the many-body Hilbert space. Very good. So I'll just, for the next 10, 15 minutes, I will just elaborate on these 3 points. So the first one is that since almost 100 years ago, we have quantum mechanics, here represented by the Schrödinger equation. And so we know the rules, the basic rules of the game. We want to study many-body problems. We know how the constituents have to be described and how they interact with each other. And what we would like precisely to do that is, now that we understand the basic rules of the game, we would like to understand how these rules, this quantum mechanics, how quantum mechanics tells us about many-body systems when we put together many of these constituents together. And so we would like to understand the emergence of collective many-body phenomena, such as superconductivity or superfluidity, quantum criticality, topological order, and so on. So as was recognized many years ago, there is a problem when we try to do that. I'm quoting Paul Dirac. He said, "The fundamental laws necessary for the mathematical treatment of a large part of physics and the whole of chemistry are thus completely known." This was said many, many years ago. And what he means is we understand the basic rules, quantum mechanics, and we can apply quantum mechanics to one system, two systems, three systems, say three atoms, and maybe analytically, maybe numerically, we can solve a three-body problem. But he goes on to say, and the difficulty lies only in the fact that application of these laws leads to equations that are too complex to be solved. So what he's saying is, well, what if we want to solve this, which really is the many-body problem? Then it turns out that we, even though we know the basic rules, what we want to solve, the basic equations, we don't know how to solve them. And relevant to this discussion is the fact that is the phenomenon of emergence, and namely that physics at large distance is often radically different from short distance. So what we're saying is that by studying one, two, or three atoms, we will really not learn much about how many atoms behave together. So really, we want to solve the many-body problem. We don't want to solve the two, three-body problem. All right, so where exactly, what is the problem? So let's look at the spin 1/2 degree of freedom. We know that it has a Hilbert space dimension too, meaning that we can represent the wave function in terms of two complex coefficients, one for spin up, one for spin down. If we want to solve two spins, we just need to consider four complex coefficients to describe the wave function, a generic wave function of four spins that would be a basis up, 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 down, down, up, down, down, and so on. Three spins, four spins, in general, n spins. Now, there is no phase transition anywhere. We can still account for two coefficients, 4, 8, 16. But the problem is, that the growth of the number of complex coefficients we need to store and manipulate in order to represent the wave function of n spins grows exponentially with n. And so how bad is this? Well, it's good to get an idea of how bad this is. And this example will illustrate it. So suppose we have a lattice of 256 spins. Its dot here is a quantum spin 1/2 degree of freedom. So if you take your laptop and you want to use, say, 10 gigabytes memory of your laptop to represent complex numbers to represent the wave function, you can ask how many spins can I cover from this construction, and it turns out that the answer is about 32 spins. Okay, so this is the largest system that you, the largest wave function that you could store in your laptop. Now we know our laptops are not as good as, you know, the best computers on Earth. So let's go directly to best computers on Earth and see whether using petabyte memory, which is the type of memories that we have in supercomputers nowadays, whether we could store all these guys. And it turns out that the answer is no. Even the largest computers on Earth could only cover a small fraction of the spins. So the largest wave function we could represent is, you know, just 16 times 3 or 48 spins. So then, you know, we want to make progress, and we want to understand what will happen in a few years when we get better computers. And what we find is that if assumed technology progresses a lot, and we manage to store one complex number, one complex coefficient on each atom in our body, then it turns out that that makes 10 to the 28 complex coefficients that we would be able to store, and that doesn't make it. And then, you know, we could consider using the Earth, storing one complex coefficient on each atom on the Earth. That would make it, solar system, Milky Way, observable universe. Finally, we have it. So we take all the observable universe and we turn it into a, you know, futuristic computer where we can store a complex number on each atom. Then we could be able, we would be able to store the wave function of this small spin system. Okay? So first conclusion, there's no way we will ever manage to represent generic wave functions of many body systems. Okay? Forget it. All right, so point number two, entanglement. What we're going to do is we're going to look at a many-body system. This time it's a spin chain, so we organize quantum spins on a line. And we're going to partition the system into two parts. We're going to call one A and the other B. So part A could be the spins here, and part B is the rest. And the basic question we're going to ask is, can we write our wave function as the product of a wave function for spins in part A and a wave function for spins in part B? Okay? And we're going to, if the answer is yes, we're going to call this a product state. So a product state is nothing but a state that can be written as the product of state for part A and state for part B. An example would be if our spin chain has all the spins pointing up, okay, then we can see that the spins on part A are pointing up, the spins on part B are pointing up, so we have a product of spins pointing up for A and spins pointing up for B. That's a product state. So now we're going to define an entangled state as a state that cannot be written in this way. And an example of that would be if all the spins in the spin chain were in a superposition of all being up and all being down. Okay? This time we cannot write this state as a state of part A times the state of part B. We need to put two pieces together. It's a linear combination of product states. So we're going to call this an entangled state. Now, the next question we want to ask, because it's going to be useful, is how much entanglement does a given entangled state have? So we're going to use a measure, in this case, the entanglement entropy. We're going to look at the state. We're going to say that the amount of entanglement between part A and B on state psi AB is going to be given by the entropy of the reduced density matrix for part A. And that's a standard description, and let me see how this looks for our superposition of spins up and spins down. When we compute the reduced density matrix on part A, what we see is that instead of having a pure state, part A now has a mixture of all the spins up and all the spins down, with coefficients 1/2 for each option. So it turns out that that means that the entropy of the reduced density matrix is equal to 1 when we define the entropy as in terms of log 2. And so what we will say is that this state, this entangled state, has one entanglement bit, or one unit of entanglement between part A and B. Okay? Whereas in the other example, if we start with a product state, when we trace out part B to compute the reduced density matrix for part A, we still have all the spins pointing up. They are still in a pure state, and therefore their entropy is going to be zero. Okay? So we have a quantitative way of saying how much entanglement we have. And now we can go for what we wanted to explain, which is, instead of worrying too much about how much entanglement is there between part A and B, what we want to understand is how much this entanglement grows as we change the size of part A. Okay, so I'm going to consider here that on part A we have L spins. And then the observation is that if we start with a generic wave function of a very long spin chain, a generic wave function will be that one that requires exponentially many coefficients. Okay, the one that we should forget about ever being able to represent efficiently. It turns out that the entropy, the entanglement entropy, depends on of part A is proportional to the size of part A. Okay, basically this entropy is counting how many degrees of freedom we have in part A. Okay, so in part A, as we make part A larger, we get more and more entropy. That's for a generic state. We also knew that for a product state, we get no entropy whatsoever. So if all the spins are pointing up, doesn't matter how you partition the system, part A will always be in a pure state, so zero entropy. And now we want to ask the question, what happens? So these are two extreme limits. Okay, a generic wave function will always give you an entropy which is proportional to the region, the size of region A. A product state will always give you zero. And so the question is, how ground states of local Hamiltonians behave compared to these extreme cases? So the scaling is here. A product state is zero entropy. A generic state, in a generic state, the entropy scales proportional to the region, the size of the region. And it turns out that when we look at ground states of local Hamiltonians, we can distinguish between two cases, massive or gap Hamiltonians, or critical or gapless Hamiltonians. And in both cases, what we have is that the entanglement scaling is either a constant or a logarithm. So it's much, much smaller than for a generic state. Okay? Generic state we could not efficiently represent, but it turns out the ground states, which we might be interested in representing, are very, very particular. They have much less entanglement than a generic state.
Can I just ask, what are you assuming about the overall size of the system?
Right. So B could be infinite. Okay. Yes.
But you're saying much bigger than A.
Definitely, yeah. Okay. Much bigger than A.
This depends on the form of the Hamiltonian.
It's a fairly generic statement. We only need to worry about whether the Hamiltonian is gapped or gapless. It's for local Hamiltonians, and it's a very generic statement. You can build counterexamples if you are in a bad mood, but yeah. I mean, that would be understandable today after last night, but okay. Good. So generically, we see the ground states have much less entanglement than generic states. Okay. And this is not, I just described one-dimensional systems, spin chains, but it happens in any number of dimensions. In one dimension, we just saw, but in two dimensions, we have a region which is square, say, or in three dimensions, a cube. And in all these cases, what we see is that there is an area law for entanglement entropy for ground states. Okay, that means physically, the physical picture you want to have here is that if we are, say, in two dimensions, and A is our region, which is, say, a square, that the entanglement only grows proportional to the size of the boundary of the region. What this is telling us is that the entanglement is entangling degrees of freedom only in the neighborhood of the boundary. Okay? In the middle of A, there is no entanglement connecting these degrees of freedom with outside, essentially.
Are you dealing with gapped or ungapped?
This would be for gap systems. And for gapless, we will have a tiny correction on top of this. And for the purpose of this talk, We'll get back to this, but it's not too important. So again, what they have in common, both Hamiltonians which are the ground state of Hamiltonians which are gap or gapless, is that the scaling is much less than this volume law. And indeed, in the gapless case, sometimes there are logarithmic corrections to this area law. Okay, so the area law would be L to the d minus 1, and sometimes we have to multiply this by log L. All right, so what we've learned, second lesson or second point, is that ground states of local Hamiltonians are very special. They are non-generic states in the Hilbert space. So the Hilbert space might be huge. That's where we would need the whole universe to represent a wave function of a small system. But we don't really care about those. If we care about ground states, then these ground states really are not, are very different from generic states in the Hilbert space. So there is hope that we might be able to efficiently represent ground states, even though we cannot represent generic states.
Aren't we usually interested in excited states as well as ground states? Don't you want to
go? We will start with ground states. We will. That's right. So we will start with ground states, and then we'll realize that when we talk about excited states, these are just excitations on top of the ground state, and many properties of the ground state are preserved. You can always drive a quantum system sufficiently away from the ground state that anything that we've learned how to efficiently simulate will fail. But if you are reasonably close to the ground state or low temperature states, you should be fine. All right, so finally, the third point, tensor networks. So here's the wave function here of, say, n spins. So this is a these indices here are labeling spin up and down for each of the n spins. And so here what we have are the complex coefficients that we don't dare to even write down because there are too many. And a tensor network, I'll iterate over this expression, but a tensor network is going to be some decomposition, some sparse decomposition of this wave function that I'll represent in this way. And let me explain what that means. So first, introduce some graphical notation, which says that whenever you see a circle, you have to think, oh, this is a complex number. If you see a circle with a leg, that's a tensor with one index, so that's a vector. Okay, so that's an array of complex numbers. If you see a circle with two legs, you want to think, okay, this is a matrix. Okay, each leg corresponds to an index, and so on. If you see a circle with three legs, that's a rank three tensor. It's a tensor with three indices. Okay, so. And then the second piece of notation, graphical notation I have to introduce is that if you see two tensors, for instance, these two tensors each have two legs, so each of these tensors is a matrix. If you see two tensors sharing an index, then there is an implicit sum over that index. So this thing here has to be read as matrix multiplication. This is a matrix, that's a matrix, there is a sum over a shared index, so that would be a usual expression for this. And the result, obviously, is another matrix. So if we multiply two matrices, we get a matrix. And that's our graphical notation, the graphical notation we'll be using for this. Similarly here, what you can see is a vector times a matrix times a vector, giving rise to a complex number. Okay. And now the question for you, and I regret that this is maybe the 10th time I ask this in the room. I ask this every year at the Psi course, at least. So if you see this, what is this? Is this a number? Is this a vector? What is this? It's a number because there are no extra external legs. And what number is this in relation? You know, you see some elements here. It's the trace of the product of four matrices. And OK, very good. And so the last question of the day. If you see this, is this, you know, this will be, when we multiply these are, I can tell you, these are tensors with three legs each. So these are three index tensors, and there are some multiplications. The result of this multiplication is what? It's a three index tensor, very good. Okay, so now we can go up here and read this expression. So on the left hand side, what we have is a single tensor with n legs. There are dots here, so you should imagine there are n legs. Okay. So this is just a representation of this, all these complex coefficients. This is the guy that we don't know how to represent in the first place because it's too large. And on the other hand, on the right-hand side, what we have is the product of a small number of tensors. And when we multiply them together, we get the number of legs that matches the number of legs we had on the other side. Okay, so the product of all these tensors together gives you a big tensor with exponentially many coefficients. Let me maybe say that again. On the left-hand side, we have a single tensor with 2 to the n coefficients. On the right-hand side, we have let's imagine we have order n tensors. So if we increase the system size by one, we'll have to add order one tensors to this. Where each tensor, we're going to assume that has some, you know, let's take this guy here. It's a tensor with a rank 3. Each index may take chi different values. So it has size. This tensor depends on chi to the 3 coefficients, some number, which we will assume that does not depend on n. Okay? So we just put together order n tensors, and each tensor has some size, which is constant. Then it follows that in total, on this side we have number of parameters which is exponential in n, and on this side we have a number of parameters which is as proportional to the number of tensors, which is n. Okay? So in this representation, it's very hard to scale the system as you increase one. When, as you add one additional spin, you have to multiply by 2 the number of parameters. On this side, when you add one extra spin, you just add a finite number of, a constant number of parameters into your representation. Okay? Inefficient, efficient. All right? So, and what are we doing here? Obviously, not all wave functions can be represented in this way. That's not going to work generic for a generic wave function. So if this is our Hilbert space, which is huge, tensor networks are just going to be able to cover some small corner. And how large this small submanifold is, well, this will depend on how large the tensors are. If we increase the range of each index, maybe we'll cover a bit more. Okay, but the idea is we will not cover everything, just a small spot. But this picture is actually similar to another picture we saw before, where I mentioned that ground states of local Hamiltonians are not generic wave functions in the whole Hilbert space, but they just cover some small part of it. And so our hope, at this point it's just hope, is that by cleverly designing these structures, there will be some non-trivial overlap between what we can efficiently represent and manipulate and what we would like to simulate. Okay? So that's our hope. Okay, and I wouldn't be giving this talk if this hope had not been realized in the last few years. And so let me give you an example of two structures, two tensor networks that can be used to simulate, efficiently represent and simulate ground states of spin chains. So the quantum system lives, you know, there is a spin for each of these open legs down here. We call this a matrix product state. We just take tensors and we multiply them in a one-dimensional array. And this happens to be useful. I'll tell you in a second, or I'll give you some idea why. And here's another tensor network that we call multi-scale entanglement renormalization ansatz. And in this case, we organize the tensors. This is still a representation for one-dimensional ground states, but we use the tensors, we organize them in two dimensions, the physical dimension and an extra dimension which will correspond to scale, to length scale in the system. Very good. So some intuition why this is useful. Let's look at how much entanglement this representation, this, suppose you represent a wave function or you consider a wave function of this form. So just put all these tensors together. Now let's ask how much entanglement could we have in this wave function? And it turns out that how much entanglement you can have is proportional to how connected the region that you are considering, this is region A, how connected it is to the rest of the tensor network. So you can ask, how many bond indices do I have to cut to split this representation into two pieces, one containing the region A that I'm interested in, and then the rest. Okay? And when you do it for the matrix product state, what you get is that it doesn't matter how large the region is, you can always cut it by cutting two bonds. Okay? And that means that the entanglement entropy that this wave function can carry is a constant, which is precisely an area law, which is precisely how ground states of gap systems scale, or the entanglement scales in ground states of gap systems. So we have at least a match between the entanglement scaling in ground states of massive or gap 1D systems and the entanglement scaling that can be supported in a matrix product state. Okay? So what about this guy? On the right-hand side, what we have is this multi-scale, or this mirror. And in this case, when we try to do the same, when we try to, given a region A, when we try to break the wave function, the tensor network, into two pieces, by cutting the smallest possible number of bonds, what we see is that this smallest possible number of bonds, this time, scales logarithmically. in the size of the region. So a small region, if this region was very small, two spins, you could get away with cutting just two bonds. As you can see, a larger region, you have to cut more bonds. Okay? And the scaling is logarithmic. So this type of tensor network produces wave functions that have logarithmic scaling of entanglement entropy, and that's a match with the scaling of entanglement entropy in critical in the ground states of critical or gapless 1D Hamiltonians. Okay? So there is a match. That doesn't mean that this is a good ansatz for ground states of gap systems or that this is a good ansatz for ground states of gapless systems, but in practice, you know, over the last 10 years, we've been, or even this structure has been there for 25 years, we've been able to gather a lot of evidence for a large variety of systems that these ansatz really produce good approximations to ground states. All right, so that was the third point I wanted to make. And so current applications of tensor networks, just to give you a bit of a big picture, we're going to think of a tensor network really as a sparse data structure, and the sparse data structure is useful in many contexts. So this business was started in the context of computational condensed matter. We wanted to efficiently simulate many-body wave functions. It turned into a very useful analytical tool as well to ask questions about many-body wave functions without involving any type of approximation or numerics. It's used in material science, quantum chemistry, classical. As a sparse data structure, it has found use also in classical, non-quantum, classical statistical mechanics, in the renormalization group, quantum field theory, machine learning, data compression, and holography and quantum gravity. So you can see there is a wide range of applications nowadays. So at PI, there is an ongoing effort in tensor networks, and this is supported by the Tensor Networks Initiative. You can read more on PI's webpage. And in particular, Ash Milstead, one of the postdocs at PI, is supported by this initiative, and we'll see some of the results he's obtained recently. And then also, the Simons Foundation is supporting two of the postdocs working at PI on tensor networks. Very good. So we are done with the gentle introduction, and now I would like to change a little bit pace. Maybe first, are there questions?
So if you consider anomalous gap systems, what is the scaling behavior? Is it constant or is it
logarithm? What's an anomalous gap system?
It lives on the boundary of a gap system in one dimension
higher. Right. I don't know if it cannot live by itself. I may have difficulties splitting the system into part A and B without involving the rest, the extra dimension. And so I don't know that those states can be characterized in a simple way. In terms of just, you know, if this is the boundary of some extended system, I don't know how to define. I may have difficulties defining entanglement just for the surface.
What if you make some choices of how you're going to factor that?
Right. Then the answer may depend on the choice. Yeah. But, you know, we could talk about this later if you want. Okay. Very good. So I want to talk about a concrete application to the renormalization group. And in order to do that, in the next half an hour, I will be talking first, reminding you what the renormalization group is about and its fixed points. And then I want to talk about how to use tensor networks to define a global scale transformation on the lattice, so changes of a scale on the lattice, together with, and once we understand how to apply a scale transformation on the lattice, we can start talking about scale invariance on the lattice. And then also do the same, but for local scale transformations. We'll define a local scale transformation on the lattice, and then a notion of local scale invariance. Okay? And a lot of what I'll say about global scale transformations is work done over the last 7 years with Glenn Evemly, who recently joined University of Sherbrooke as a faculty. And the results that I'll mention about local scale invariant, local scale transformations and invariants, these are results, very recent results, some of them from last week, developed here at Perimeter with Ash. Very good. So, renormalization group. What we want to remember here is that when we specify our a system of interest, a many-body system, in terms of some Hamiltonian. And to be concrete, we could talk about, say, the Ising model in a spin chain. So when we specify the Hamiltonian, usually what we do is we say, OK, this Hamiltonian is made of different terms, sigma x, nearest neighbor, between nearest neighbors, sigma z on site. And we could think of this as j and lambda as two couplings that we can organize in a way that actually this is just a Hamiltonian of a very large family of Hamiltonians with many, many couplings, where we set most couplings to zero, and we just have these two couplings taking non-zero values. And now what we want to understand is what happens when we study this, the many-body system as a function, its behavior as a function of a scale. And so it turns out that when you the physics of a many-body system depends on scale, and as you change scale, you could effectively represent that many-body system by a new Hamiltonian where you just change the couplings. Okay, so the basic idea, due to Leo Kadanoff, Kenneth Wilson, and others, is that we can study a flow in the space of couplings as a means to understand how the system evolves, or the properties of the system change as we change scale. So in this space of couplings, this space of couplings is very large. In principle, we have infinitely many coupling constants here. But the idea is that your system starts somewhere, and you change scale, and then it moves to some other place, and it evolves until it hits some fixed point. So the fixed points of the RG flow, or this flow of in the space of couplings of a Hamiltonian, the fixed points are of interest because they actually are representative of the low energy, long distance behavior of a phase. And so they capture the universal features of the different phases in which your system can be. There are stable fixed points corresponding to gap phases, and then there are unstable fixed points where there are directions that could take you away from those, and these correspond to critical systems. Very good. So in all these ideas, which are very important, essential contributions to physics over the last century, all these ideas are based on the notion that you can change scale. Okay, so when the renormalization group was first formulated, it was not just some abstract set of ideas, but actually came with concrete proposals how to change scale. And that was done in terms of Cosgrain transformations. So for instance, we can take Kadanoff's block spin Cosgrain transformation, where what you do is you have your two-dimensional lattice of spins, and you look at the configuration of the spins, and you decide that you're going to block three spins and replace them by one. So we change scale by looking at configurations of spins, cosgraining those configurations by some rule, so that every three spins that we have here, now we just have one spin. Okay, that's a change of a scale. And the idea is that there is some rule. For instance, we could use this majority boat, very appropriate today, again, you count how many spins in the block are down, how many spins in the block are up. Oh no, that's not what happened yesterday. And then you replace your block by a single spin, which depends, it's up or down, depending on who wins on these three spins. Okay? So it's some rule. You may think, okay, why the rule? Why not something else? That's a legitimate question. Wilson also proposed this another way of proceeding in momentum space for continuous systems, where you basically have some initial Hamiltonian and you do some integration. You integrate a momentum space, a shell of momenta to shift your cutoff, so high momenta. You integrate in the space of all possible momenta, you integrate some high momenta, and this defines some effective couplings. Okay, so there are proposals. These ideas came with concrete proposals as to what it means to change scale. And so what I'm going to do today is I'm going to take the main ideas, and I'm just going to discuss an alternative proposal of how to implement this scale transformation, specifically for the case of quantum many-body systems. So what we want to think is that this tensor network that we've seen before is describing not just a wave function. I told you before, if we contract all these indices, if we multiply all these tensors together, we get a single big tensor with many open indices, and that describes the exponentially many coefficients of the wave function. But if you think about it, you could also, from the same structure, you could cut the structure in different places and not just get one wave function, but get the sequence of wave functions. So the original wave function corresponds to multiplying all the indices together. If we happen to remove one double layer of tensors, we end up with some other structure, some other tensor network, describing another wave function, and so on. You can keep eliminating layers of tensors, okay? And so what we have is not one wave function, but a sequence of wave functions. And if you look at it, what's happening is we started with n spins, and after one layer, after removing this layer, we have a new lattice which corresponds to half of the spins, one fourth of the spins. So there is this notion that we are actually putting together blocks of spins and replacing them with single spins. Okay, so it's similar to Kadanoff spin blocking. Okay, so Mera defines an energy flow in the space of wave functions. That's what I just said. And so now we could.
So just ask a question. As you remove these layers, are you going to change the Hamiltonian?
We will see that for the time being, I want to discuss just wave functions, and Hamiltonians will come in a minute.
But you will have to do that.
Yes. There are some rules how the Hamiltonian transforms under this Cosgrainian transformation. But the basic idea first is that it is indeed possible to study the flow, this RG flow, but not in the space of couplings of the Hamiltonian, but in the space of wave functions. So you could similarly have that your wave function changes as you change the scale, and it could be flowing to some fixed point. Okay. Very good. So let's have a look at this Cosgrainian transformation. This is the one that it's a layer, the double layer of tensors in Mera. And what we have is that indeed we start with some number of spins. We apply these tensors. These tensors define a linear map between our initial lattice with n spins and a final lattice with n over 2 spins. Okay, it's a linear map that tells us how to transform the Hilbert space of the lattice. And there are some rules that basically say that these tensors here are unitary in the sense that when you multiply them with their adjoint, give rise to identity. And these tensors here are isometric in the sense that when you multiply them with its adjoint, again, give rise to the identity in a single site. Good, so some rules. And now let's try to see what happens, trying to answer the question that Neil just asked, what happens when we apply this type of Cosgrainian transformation to a local operator. So this is our local operator. You see it's an operator acting on 3 sites, okay? And the statement is that, or the claim is that, under this Cosgrainian transformation, it will be mapped into an operator that acts also only on 3 sites. So 3 sites down here, an operator acting on 3 sites here will be mapped into an operator acting on 3 sites there. And this is very easy to see, so let's have a look at it. This is our 3-site operator, okay? And how do we apply a map that is supposed to act on states? How do we apply it to an operator? Well, by conjugation. So we'll multiply bra and ket-wise, okay? And now we'll use the rules here that tell us that if this is U, this is U dagger, so we can simplify these tensors, also these ones, then these ones, applying the rules. And if you think about it for a minute, you'll realize that this big mess is simplified into this thing, which is now trivial, acting as the identity on all the sites except for this central 3. Okay, so there you have it. A local operator acting on 3 spins, on 3 sides of the microscopic lattice, and the Cosgrainian is mapped into a local operator on the Cosgrainian lattice, acting again on 3 sides only. So local to local. Very good. So what we have then is a Cosgrainian transformation that preserves locality. That's very useful. So as I said before, Mera defines an RG flow in the space of wave functions. We don't get just one wave function, but a collection of them. But now we know that we could apply this, the Cosgrainian transformation that we used to change the wave function, we could apply it to a local Hamiltonian. If we have a local Hamiltonian that is made of as a sum of 3, at most 3 side terms, when we Cosgrain each of these terms, we'll get still a local term. So a sum of local terms is mapped into a sum of local terms by linearity. Okay? So we have a Gaussian transformation that maps local Hamiltonians into local Hamiltonians. And this will define also a flow in the space of Hamiltonians. Okay? So we have an RG flow in the space of wave function, an RG flow in the space of Hamiltonians. Now, everybody can come and propose a Gaussian transformation, and the question is that going to be any useful? Is this proposed Gaussian transformation, this proposed RG flow, is it useful for anything? And for instance, the first question we could answer or ask is, why should we be using this? Why don't we use, say, this one? This one, we would take two spins, and we mapped into single spin. Here, we did something else, more complicated. Okay. Well, this is closer to Kadanoff spin blocking. It's actually a quantum version of Kadanoff spin blocking. So why should not? Why don't we just use this one? And actually, what we didn't know, what was not known when we started doing RG transformations many years ago, is some key insight that we've learned just in recent years, which has to do with entanglement. Remember, this Gaussian transformation, in particular, we want this Gaussian transformation to preserve the low energy properties, long distance properties of our system, in particular the ground state. And this is why the Gaussian transformation defines the ground state of the system. Okay? The meta is made of just Gaussian transformations one after the other. Now, we nowadays know that we could also use an ansatz, a variational ansatz, a tensor network that follows directly from this type of Gaussian transformation. Here it is. It's called a tree-tensor network. Okay? And what we've learned about the tree-tensor network is that it's not capable of supporting the type of entanglement scaling that is required to define, to describe, for instance, a critical fixed point of the RG flow. So it turns out that if you look at the entanglement that can be supported by a tree-tensor network, it's you can always split, you can make a larger and larger blocks and always break that block from the rest of the wave function by cutting just one index. Okay? That means that in this wave function, the entropy is at most constant. The scaling of entropy, okay, is at most constant. That follows directly from the connectivity of the tensor network that comes here. And so what that tells us is that if we were to try to use this type of Gaussian transformation to describe a critical system, to study a critical system, we would fail from the beginning. Okay? Because the resulting structure that is coming out is not capable of reproducing the quantum correlations that are there in a quantum, in a critical system. Okay, so this is really recent insight. Over the last 10 years, this was not understood, not even asked when the renormalization group was first proposed. So this is why this type of Gaussian transformation has more potential of success compared to just spin blocking. It properly reproduces the scaling of entanglement that we know nowadays that is there. Very good. So what is a proper RG transformation on the lattice? We keep asking this question. We just said, OK, the spin blocking alone is not going to do it. But why should this do it? Well, at this point, we have to go and try. Okay? We argued a little bit, but now we have to go and try, see how it performs. And the first observation, numerical observation, is that meta, the RG flow that comes from this tensor network seems to be qualitatively correct. It's consistent with any expectation that we learn from quantum field theory. So for instance, when we apply it to a free particle theory, okay, we can do the calculations there more efficiently even. And what we see is that starting from a small mass and the Gaussian transformation will grow, as we know that would happen in the continuum. So we're working on a lattice, but we see that the RG flow generated on the lattice is qualitatively similar to the one that we have already learned from the continuum. So that's good, but we want to go beyond qualitative and we would like to go quantitative. We'd like to see whether meta really can be trusted as a tool to explore RG flows. And so what's an interesting way of going quantitative there is to analyze the fixed points. So in meta, we said that we can also reach fixed points. Okay, And now the question is, when we reach a fixed point, whether it looks at all like a fixed point in the continuum, which corresponds to a conformal field theory. So the question we want to ask in the last 10 minutes, I guess, is how good this structure, this tensor network, will be at describing critical fixed points that have an underlying CFT. So what do we need to know about conformal field theories that we would like to be able to reproduce on the lattice? Well, conformal field theory is a vast subject, and I have no chance to describe it to you in 10 minutes. But there are three things that we're going to be looking at. One is scaling operators. So a scaling operator is an operator of the theory that under a scale, change of scale, as under a scale transformation, it's an operator that is mapped into itself times a constant, and where this constant depends on its scaling dimension. So a scaling operator is an operator that is mapped into itself, okay, under scaling transformations. And then under Lorentz boosts or rotations in the Euclidean plane, this operator will be again mapped into itself times a phase. And so both the rescaling and the phase of this under scale transformations and Lorentz boost will be given by what's called scaling dimension of the field and the conformal spin of the field. So we have these scaling operators. And then, for instance, for the CFT that corresponds to the criticalizing model, what we have are some fields, some scaling operators that are called primary fields, which there are three of them. One is called identity, the other is called spin, primary, and the energy density. Okay, and they have some scaling dimensions, which is 0, 1 over 8, and 1. Okay, and so what we would like to do is to see whether when we study the criticalizing model with a meta, we recover, we can extract this information from it. Okay, so I mentioned three scaling operators, but as a matter of fact, there are many more. And so if we plot them according to their scaling dimension and conformal spin, okay, according to how they transform under scale transformations and how they transform under rotations, then what we see is that, well, we just mentioned three, what we call primaries, the identity, spin, and energy density. But there are many more, okay? And I'm using colors for a reason, but the idea is there are infinitely many, actually. This continues, this goes on forever. What else do we know about conformal field theories? Well, when we have a theory with global scale and rotation invariants, and it's a local theory, typically this invariance is promoted from global to local, and so we end up with a conformal group. That's actually the group of symmetries of a conformal field theory. And what that means is, well, the second thing we need to know about conformal field theory is that all these scaling operators are organized into conformal towers, which is the same saying that these are the irreducible representations under the conformal group. So if instead of global scale and rotation transformations, which would leave each of these points on its own, if we apply local scale transformations and local rotations, then these guys will mix, okay? But according to some rules, they will be organized in irreducible representations, and that's what the different colors mean, So the red guys will transform under these conformal transformations among themselves, but they will not mix with the blue guys or the green guys and so on, okay? So we have these irreducible representations. And the primary fields that I mentioned before are just the highest weight states. They are at the bottom of these conformal towers. Very good. So that's something. I think my time is up. Is there anything I should be doing? Okay. No?
I'm only done.
Okay. Yeah. All right, so finally I wanted to mention that third thing we need to know about conformal field theories is that when you take two scaling operators and you look at them from far away, you can replace them effectively by a sum of scaling operators again. Okay, so they form in some sense a basis of local operators. So this is known as the operator product expansion, that you can replace two scaling operators that are close to each other by a sum of single scaling operators. Very good. So, and then there is the final fact about conformal field theories is that if we there is the so-called conformal data, which is the minimal set of information you have to specify to completely characterize the CFT, in the sense that the rest of properties of the CFT will follow from symmetry, and this conformal data consists of something called the central charge, which I will not describe, and then primary fields, together with their scaling dimensions, conformal spins, so how they scale under global scale transformations, how these fields transform under rotations, and finally how this the operator product expansion coefficients, how these fields fuse with each other. Okay, so if you give me that for primary fields, then you have completely specified the CFT. So in the case of the Ising model, we already mentioned, well, the central charge is not going to play any role today. So let's look at the spin, at the primary fields. We said we had three of them. We know their scaling dimensions. And then the only thing that is new is this operator product expansion coefficients. The only non-trivial one is the one that fuses energy density with spin to give rise to spin. And it has an amplitude 2.5. All right, so to the point. We would like to see whether we can extract all this information from the lattice. We would like to see whether now that we have a notion, we propose a notion of a scale transformation on the lattice, we'd like to see whether this notion of a scale transformation, okay, which automatically gives us a notion of a scale invariance, right? If we have a scale transformation, we can ask under which situations we get back the same theory when we cosgrain it. We'd like to see whether this leads to something useful. So we can say that the state, the wave function, is a scale invariant if it's invariant under this transformation. And here's a trick to build scale invariant wave functions. I just take this scale transformation and multiply it infinitely many times. And this you can show that it produces a wave function for an infinite lattice. And it's quite trivial to see that if there is an infinite tower of those, if you multiply this state by an extra W, well, it still looks like an infinite tower of W's, so it's still the same object, the same wave function. And so this is maybe a silly construction that gives rise to a scale invariant wave function if we define a scale invariant by invariance under this scale transformation. So are we just playing with words, or is this useful? And
one question, is there a reason why the eigenvalue is 1 and not a complex thing? As you're defining psi to be scale invariant if under W returns the same state, but
right. So we have a wave function of an infinite system, and I'm not even sure what the phase would mean.
Well,
but I cannot think of this playing a role in this discussion. Okay, so is this useful? And well, it is useful because it will give rise, it will give us access to conformal data. In particular, we will be able to extract scaling dimensions and the operator product expansion coefficients. And let me tell you how this works in practice. So what you want to do is you give me the critical Hamiltonian, a critical Hamiltonian, say for the Ising model, that's a Hamiltonian on the lattice. And now I'm just going to use as a variational ansatz, I'm going to assume that the ground state of this Hamiltonian can be written as this on an infinite lattice, can be written as this infinite tower of cosgrain transformations. Okay? It's an ansatz. You may like it or not, but you know, we're going to restrict our attention to wave functions that have this form. And this wave function is actually characterized by a single disentangler and a single isometry repeated infinitely many times throughout this tensor network. So we're going to treat this disentangler and this isometry as two tensors full of complex coefficients, which are going to be our variational parameters. Okay? And Well, you know, this might be an interesting ansatz or not, but given an ansatz, a variational ansatz, you can always ask how much is the expectation value by the Hamiltonian? So what's the energy of this wave function? And then you can try to minimize over the variational parameters. You can try to minimize the expectation value of the energy over the variational parameters. And what you can do is, well, nowadays you can do that in, say, you spend an hour in your laptop, or your laptop spends an hour doing this optimization. And after that, you can build this map. Remember that we said the local operators are mapped into local operators? So what we're going to do is we're going to ask, OK, so there is a linear map here built from the optimized disentangled isometries that will map a local operator into a local operator. And we would like to ask the question, what local operators are mapped into themselves? OK, so we have optimized these variational parameters. We're done with asking questions to the Hamiltonian. And now we want to see whether we can extract information from this optimized Cochrane transformation. And the way we do that is by diagonalizing the linear map that takes local operators into local operators. If you diagonalize the linear map, you'll obtain the eigenvectors of this linear map are precisely the operators, three-site operators that are mapped into themselves times some eigenvalue. And from the eigenvalue, you can read the scaling dimensions. And when you do that, well, after an hour of calculation for the criticalizing model, you get that the scaling dimensions are organized in some nice way. So this is just reading the eigenvalues of this linear map. And in particular, we identify high precision, high accuracy approximations to the scaling dimensions of the spin and of the energy density. This should be 1 over 8, so 1, 2, 5. And we got some mistake, some error on the sixth digit. And this should be a 1. And yeah, so there are a few digits correct. And yeah, there are other scaling operators that I'm not going to discuss. And then we can also obtain by taking, now that we have these scaling operators on the lattice, we can ask how do they fuse together under Cochrane transformation. And we can re-express them. So we can take two of those, tensor product them, Cochrane them, and see how they decompose again into scaling operators. And what we see is, well, that they obey the, that they transform according to the operator product expansion coefficients with some three digits of accuracy. Okay? So the conclusion is that not only we get a qualitatively correct flow according to what we would expect from quantum field theory, but actually when we look at the fixed points, they are accurately approximated, so in the sense that we can extract the universal data of the underlying CFT. And my time is up. So the last part that I want to, well, I started 3 minutes late. So Jaume, how did we, yeah, OK, 3 more minutes, right? Very good. Thanks, Jaume. We come from the same city. So that was nice. We can extract information. Scaling dimensions, operator product expansion. But how about conformal spins? How about identifying who are the primary operators? How about the structure of the conformal towers? Where is this? And it turns out that we can also extract all this information. But instead of considering global scale transformations, which is what we've been doing so far, and that's the work that I have been doing with Glenn, we're going to be looking at local scale transformations, which is the new stuff. All right. So. Another CFT fact that I don't have time to explain too well, but is well understood, is that, and we learned that from John Cardick, who is a distinguished visiting research chair at Perimeter. So in the late 80s, he explained that if you diagonalize a spin chain on a finite geometry with periodic boundary conditions, and you look at the spectrum, low energy spectrum of energies and momenta, of this spin chain, then actually, from the energies and the momenta, you could extract the scaling dimensions and the conformal spins of the CFT. Okay, so that is very good. We can get scaling dimensions. We can get conformal spins. That's great. But how about primary operators? How about the conformal towers? So if you want, this looks excellent. It's a source. It allows us to estimate numerically scaling dimensions and conformal spin. But what we're missing here is the structure of conformal towers. Okay. And that's not no surprise, because all that we invoked in order to obtain this plot was the Hamiltonian and the momentum operator on the theory, which correspond to not to local scaling transformations, but just global scaling transformations through the through some theory. Very good. So what we had so far was a global scale transformation, and now we could try, because since we see that this cosgrain transformation breaks naturally into pieces, how about we just apply it locally? How about we just cosgrain or fine grain in a local region, and we do nothing in the rest of the chain, the spin chain? And that's what we tried at some point, and it failed. But recently we understood that actually a small variation of this construction will do the trick, where this additional tensor, so remember this U and W, they come directly from an energy minimization. And we can put them together locally. And now what we're saying is that's not good enough to make a local scale transformation on the lattice. We need to invoke or to involve two new tensors, some magic tensors, which happen to have some fulfill some relation with these entanglers and isometries. And once we do that, we obtain some interesting local scale transformations that we'll test in a second. And in order to stay within the, so if we want to stay within the same Hilbert space, so imagine I have now a lattice with 10 sites. If I apply a local scale transformation, I go into, instead of 10, 12 sites. Well, that's going to make the comparison of the action of, we prefer to work with situations where the number of sites before and after the local scale transformation are the same. And when we do that, that's what we call a balanced scale transformation. Very interesting things happen. So what I'm going to do first is I'm going to apply one of these transformations, where I'm going to split one site into two, and I'm going to take two sites together into one. So this site is going to be, these two sites are going to be merged, and this site is going to be split into two. And there is a way of understanding this as doing some form of translation in one direction and in the opposite direction. And there is some interpretation of that. When we do that, and we now apply this local scale transformation to the ground state of the theory, suddenly the ground state is mapped into some of its conformal descendants. Okay. So suddenly we are starting to see on the lattice the conformal group acting. When we apply the same map, the same local scale transformation to another eigenstate of the Hamiltonian in the same conformal tower, then it excites again, or it transforms this state into a linear combination of other states in the same conformal tower. In this way, we can identify the conformal tower of the identity. If we do the same acting on, say, an excited state that corresponds to the spin primary field, we get a linear combination of, again, states only in the same conformal tower. And so in this way, we can identify a conformal tower of the spin primary field, and the same for the energy density. Okay. So if you want, in one sentence, since the work of Cardi in 1980, Cardi equipped with heavy, with the whole technology given by the conformal group, managed to tell us what we should do to extract universal information from a spin chain by diagonalizing a spin chain and looking at the momenta and energies and identifying spins, conformal spins and scaling dimensions. And then it took us 27 years, or twicely, equipped with crayons, to actually take the same plot and start coloring it a little bit, okay? So the meaning of this coloring is actually that it's a confirmation that using tensor networks, we can define, we can build and apply local scale transformations on the lattice. And these transformations will have the same effect on the low energy subspace of the lattice as the one predicted by conformal field theory. Okay, so this is a very strong confirmation that our proposed local scale transformations are doing exactly what they should be doing. So that's a validation that this indeed is the right way to apply local scale transformations on the lattice. Okay, and Yeah, for the experts, we can also apply this to see quasi-primaries and global conformal towers instead of the Birrell-Strouhal towers and so on. But my time is up. So the summary is that entanglement, well, today we saw that entanglement, quantum entanglement is useful in order to understand how to efficiently represent wave functions. And this is done in terms of tensor networks. And I explain a concrete application of the tensor network formalism to the renormalization group. What else? Well, there are many, I told you, tensor networks are applied in many different places. Here at PI, there are several people working on this, and let me mention some students. So the Euclidean path integral, so there is an Euclidean path integral version of this formalism, and there are three PhD students working on that at PI. There is a continuous version of tensor networks where instead of trying to describe wave functions on the lattice, we can directly describe wave functions in the continuum, so wave functionals. And there are a number of people, again, working on that. And finally, there is this tensor network holography, where tensor networks are explored or discussed in the context of maybe being a realization of the ADS-CFT correspondence. And again, there are a number of people working on this. OK, thank you.
Sorry. So can you do it for the 3D IU model? What you did for the 2D IU model? Look at the what are the operators which survive, which are.
So can we go from two to three dimensions?
Yeah.
Well, that's precisely what Marcus Clemon and Sebastian are exploring. They've been developing new strategies to more efficiently deal with three-dimensional systems. And I think it's work in progress, but it's looking much better than the last time we had tried, which was 5 years ago or so, and we had to give up. So there is, in principle, there is no obstruction. There is no exponential growth of complexity. But we need better machines, we need better strategies. So it's in the details, but the details are sufficiently tough that we have not been able to reproduce that we cannot reproduce the success of two dimensions in three dimensions.
When you look at gauge theory, where your degrees of freedom live on links on site?
There has been plenty of work in using gauge theories on the lattice. A number of groups are working on this at the moment. There was a new two papers this week on that, where they study Schwingel, I think three species some number of colors. I was preparing this talk and I couldn't read the details, but they are used. Tensor networks are used to study theories, gauge theories, in 1+1 at the moment. 1+1 dimensions.
Has there been any work on tensor networks, representations of fixed states? So I'm thinking, like, if you wanted to study phase transitions as you're lowering the temperature, you could just consider your density operator as a vector in the space formation operators, make your tensor network nonsense, and see what you get. I'm just curious, have people done this?
Yeah, so I mentioned that we use those techniques also for classical statistical mechanics.
Yeah.
To describe thermal states, yes. Are you talking about classical systems or quantum systems?
Well, I was thinking quantum systems.
Okay, the answer is also yes. So we also do thermal states where entanglement is not the key, but correlations are the key. Where we need a sparse structure that exploits the fact that correlations in a thermal state for a quantum system, correlations scale, again, it's not the entanglement entropy this time, right? But the correlation still obeys, as measured maybe by some mutual information, they still obey some form of area law.
And I'm expressing my ignorance here, but can you understand, you know, critical points under variations of temperature using
I have not looked into critical points, thermal critical points. I have not looked at that. I don't know.
when we look at the tree tensor network as embodying Cardanov RG, if we wanted to maintain the correct scaling of entanglement, then the dimensions of tensors at higher levels would correspondingly increase.
Will grow exponentially with the number of steps.
Okay. So in that picture, any truncation of the dimension of Hilbert space seems to correspond to a matter of convenience. So would you say that is where the irreversibility of RG comes from? Or if, for example, we kept the dimension of Hilbert space growing exponentially, it would seem like the process would be reversible.
You could keep the whole Hilbert space and never truncate anything. And then you could reverse that. So are you asking whether the irreversibility comes from the truncation? I'm not sure that the RG flow is irreversible, right? So when you study this flow, if you don't put finite precision in the space of couplings, I don't see why. I mean, it's not that two theories merge, right? They become arbitrarily close, but if you don't put a fine grain, if you don't have a lattice there in the space of parameters, you, in principle, you could reverse that.
At some point, you considered this—I forgot what you called it—but this tree, tensor tree.
Yes.
And you argue that in 1+1 dimension, it's inadequate because it doesn't capture the logarithmic entanglement. Now, in higher dimensions, critical theories have a normal area law; they don't have this logarithmic scaling. So. I wonder, have you thought about using the simpler kind of narrative? Yeah. Got it. So in higher dimensions,
a tree will give you a constant entropy. Again, constant is not the area law in 2 dimensions. In 2+.
Just constant, independent of the perimeter.
Mm-hmm. So it's really poor.
So it's even worse.
It's much worse. In a tree, there are always regions that are cosgrained to a single side. So they are connected in 1D and 2D. They are connected, so the whole region is connected to the rest of the tensor network through a single link. That is true in any dimension.
Don't you reorganize the tree so it's built in more?
That's the problem, that this could be already in 2 dimensions. Because I just need to snake around the 2 dimensions. So this is a 1-dimensional geometry, and you can cover 2 dimensions on a lattice just by going around.
But you can't reorganize this in some way to build in more connections.
No, there will always be the region corresponding to these sides, whether they are organizing 1 dimension or 2. The region will be connected only through one bond to the rest of the wave function. So that means a constant amount of entropy.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if I can't reorganize the layers so they don't in this sort of trivial way.
I can always look at the opposite construction, right? I say, okay, if I cut this index, I'm splitting the wave function into 2,
right.
And that corresponds to splitting 2 sets of spins
right.
That should be very entangled. And now it's just constant entanglement that I can account for, so there is no way.
Asking if there are other schemes.
Based on a tree, no. There is no way out.
There's no version of simple blocking that could work in higher dimensions.
If blocking means a tree, no.
Well, I don't know what it means.
There must be an infinite ways, the number of ways of blocking. Mirror is one.
Right. No. I'm saying if blocking means a tree,
no.
Then we have a problem.
Let's say blocking just means 2 to 1.
Okay. Then there are infinitely many ways you could try. Yes.
Could any of those reproduce the right scaling?
Sure. I mean, there are no go theorems apart from this guy for the theory, right?
There are no go theorems.
Right. There are no go theorems that I know of.
Right.
Yes. So you can go and try some new structure.
So have you got any favorite? Graphical structure for higher dimensions.
Yes, but I don't know how to draw it. So it's, you should ask Marcus. Marcus, are you around? Marcus has been specializing in drawing higher dimensional structures and, I don't know. The starting point was the critical Hamiltonian.
Can you imagine if you have Hamiltonian, you want to know if that's a critical point or not? Because this approach answers the question of the fixed point somewhere. By doing the some couple more. Or you have to be sitting at the fixed point.
So you could try the scale invariant ansatz at different couplings. And you will see that in some cases it gives you a good approximation to the ground state, and in some cases it does not. And you could take that as an indication that you are close to a critical point.
But can this be used to find
people? So in principle, yes. We don't have any working algorithm because, it was not a priority. I think it could be done.
Okay. So you mentioned in your last slide that there were applications of tensor networks to path controls. I was just wondering if you could summarize what the idea is there.
Right, so what you can do is you can work with a Lagrangian formalism. So instead, your tensor network, it is well understood how to represent an Euclidean path integral as a tensor network. And the work there that needs to be done is how to contract all this tensor network and extract the information out of it. Right? So writing something as a tensor network doesn't mean that you have an efficient way of contracting the tensor network. You have an efficient representation, but you still need to understand how to efficiently contract it or manipulate it. Right? So you have this bunch of tensors. You can specify them efficiently, but you don't know how to multiply them together. And so there has been, over the last 3-4 years, a lot of progress in new schemes, how to extract this information efficiently.
So the legs of the tensor correspond to what in path integral version?
In the path integral version, you could think that your starting point is something like a Boltzmann weights for the classical partition function analog of that. And it's just a way of rewriting those Boltzmann weights. It's a local reorganization of your degrees of freedom.
You have a prescription for local scale transformations. Can you use it to test criticality without conformal invariants, like systems that are critical but not conformal invariants? Or does this prescription rely heavily on the fact that you have conformal invariants?
So the prescription, we only understand it for conformal invariant systems, or for critical fixed points that have a CFT attached to them.
Okay, so you're calling it local scale transformation. And when you do RG, the only thing that you care about is just changing the scale. So I don't know if you've tried
right.
for a system.
No, we don't even know yet how to define it unless we're at the fixed point. So this local scale transformation involves these magic gates that I were, I'm not going to touch the slide. There were two new gates that were fulfilling some interesting relations with the existing gates. That we have only observe that such solutions to those equations exist when we are at the fixed point. So we are thinking that there will be more of such relations, and maybe this gives rise to some tensor network bootstrap approach, where if you manage to fulfill all those relations, if you find tensors that fulfill all those relations, then you have those tensors represent the CFT. But these are really early days for this type of questions, because some of these results are from last week.
Okay, so thank you for your time.